And we are at the top of the hour now, so at this time I would like to introduce our speaker. Joining us today we have Dr. Sally Haskell. She's the Deputy Chief Consultant for Clinical Operations and Director for Comprehensive Women's Health and Women's Health Services at Patient Care Services for the Veterans Health Administration, and she's also a professor at the Yale School of Medicine. So without further ado, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Haskell.
Thank you. Sorry, I was on mute. So let me just get myself on slideshow here. And I should be all set to go. Okay. So hello, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here today to talk to you about WATCH. And WATCH stands for the Women's Assessment Tool for Comprehensive Health. And this is an annual survey that we do in women's health to assess the implementation of comprehensive women's health. So we're going to start off today just by asking you a couple of poll questions so that I can understand who is in the audience, and that will help me as we go through the presentation. So please let us know what your primary role in VA is.
Thank you. So for our attendees, just go ahead and select the circle right there next to your response. Those answer options are women's health primary care provider, other clinician or trainee, researcher, women veteran program manager, or other or administrator. And please note if you are selecting other, we will have a more extensive list of job titles in the feedback survey. So you might find your exact one there to select. And with that, I'm going to close out the poll and share those results. It looks like 35% of our respondents selected other clinician or trainee, 30% selected researcher, 10% women veteran program manager, and 25% other or administrator. So thank you to those respondents. And Sally, do you have any commentary before I move on to the next poll?
No, thank you for that information. That's really helpful, and we'll move on to the next one.
Great. So we'd like to get an idea. Were you involved in the WATCH survey? The answer options are a directly completed survey, provided data for survey, aware of WATCH but not involved, or was not aware of the WATCH survey. We'll give people a few more seconds to get their responses in. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll out and share the results. We have 7% selected directly completed the survey, 0 provided data for survey, 26% aware of WATCH but were not involved, and 67% was not aware of WATCH survey. So thank you to those respondents. And with that, I will turn it back over to you, Dr. Haskell. You should have that pop up on your screen again.
There we go. Okay, well, actually, that was really interesting and helpful to me, so that I see that the majority of folks who are on the call were actually not even aware of the WATCH survey. So that means I need to give you a little bit more detailed information. So the WATCH initiative is an online survey. It's completed by the Women Veteran Program Managers, and we've been doing this every year since 2010. They do it in the fall of every year. And then they actually complete it on paper, and it's reviewed by their facility and VISN leadership before it's submitted to make sure that everyone's in agreement with the information that's submitted. So the design of the survey is that it's actually in three parts. Today we're going to be reporting on the first two parts, Part A and Part B. So Part A is a healthcare system survey, so that the Women Veteran Program Manager at a facility reports on the characteristics of the women's health program at the healthcare system level, the healthcare system being the parent medical center and its associated CBOX. And that includes the demographics and enrollment and utilization data for the women veterans at that healthcare system, and also the women's health program management and staff and their strategic planning efforts. Part B is what we call the site-specific survey, and that is kind of an ordeal for the Women Veteran Program Managers because they complete it for every site of care within their system. So they complete it separately for each medical center in CBOC, and not only that, they have to complete it for each model of care. So if there is a women's health clinic at a medical center, but some of the women are also followed in the general primary care clinic, then the Woman Veteran Program Manager completes it for those individual models of care and sites of care. And this part of the survey collects information on designated women's health primary care providers and PACT teams in each site of care and model of care. So, and I'm realizing actually that because a lot of you said you weren't familiar with the WATCH survey, that many of you may not be familiar with our women's health models of care. We have three models of care that we describe that sites, women veterans can be seen in any of the three models of care, model one being an integrated general primary care clinic where men and women are both seen. Model two is what we call a separate but shared space, and model three is a comprehensive women's clinic that has a separate entrance and a separate waiting area. So let me go on with the methods now. So the Women Veteran Program Managers completed their self-assessments of their women's health program at 140 healthcare systems. And just a reminder that a healthcare system includes the parent site and all the sites affiliated with that parent. They would basically get a drop-down menu for all of the sites in their healthcare system that are based on the VAST list, which is a list of all of the sites of care in the VA. It does include only sites that provide primary care. So this slide shows you the WATCH self-assessment report, and that's just a reminder that all of this data is available in VSSC. So I would encourage you, if you go to the VSSC homepage, look under Women's Health, and you'll be able to get access to this report. And it gives the report, at the facility or VISN or national level. I wanted to just update on the number of medical centers and the number of CBOCs because that keeps changing every year, and sometimes that can be confusing. So as of this report, there were still 140 healthcare systems, but there were 165 medical centers and 870 CBOCs, meaning that there were over 1,000 sites of care. Some healthcare systems, I guess more than there used to be, have more than one medical center in that healthcare system. And some of this is due to reclassifications where some of the, something that may have been considered a large CBOC or healthcare center in the past is now considered a medical center. So I'll start off talking about women veteran enrollment. The population of women veterans has grown very rapidly over the last 15 years or so, as I think you are all probably aware. But we now have over 740,000 women actually enrolled in VA care. What you'll notice is that in spite of this rapid growth of the population, a lot of people expect that it might be the younger women that make up the bulk of the population, but our largest population group is actually in the 45 to 64-year-old age range. So as we think about women's health services, we really have a very wide spectrum of types of services we have to provide, ranging from reproductive health care for our younger women up through menopausal care, as well as care for chronic medical conditions, and then geriatric and long-term care as well. So we have less women that are actually receiving care, but nearly 500,000. And again, you'll see the same distribution in age range, where the largest population is in that 45 to 64-year-old age group. This is a very interesting slide that lets us know where our women are receiving care within our healthcare system. What you'll see is that the bulk of the women, the largest group, are receiving care in primary care, which is stop code 323, and that stop code refers to integrated primary care clinics. So a lot of people are under the misconception that most women are receiving their care in comprehensive women's primary care clinics. You'll see that that's actually a much smaller number. We do have a policy that women need to be receiving their care from designated women's health primary care providers and women's health PAC teams. Those designated women's health primary care providers can actually practice in either a comprehensive women's clinic or a Model 1 clinic, which I described before, which is an integrated primary care clinic, the stop code 323, or a Model 2 clinic, which is a separate but shared space. Then you'll see that a smaller number of women are actually seen in gynecology. A lot of our basic gynecology care, things like pap smears and such, is actually done by our primary care providers, by our designated women's health primary care providers. The stop code 704 refers to a gender-specific preventive care clinic, which is something like what we used to call a pap clinic. That's been a practice that we've been trying to discourage because it causes fragmented care to have a woman have to return to a separate provider for their gender-specific care. So as we've implemented comprehensive primary care for women, we want to see the numbers that are seen in the 704 clinics go down, the numbers that are seen in the 322 and the 323 clinics go up. And then, again, a fairly large number of women seen in emergency departments. This slide shows you the variation in enrollment across the 140 healthcare systems, and it's really just meant to show you that there is a very wide range of rates of enrollment, and this really describes the market penetration, so that's the percent of women who live in a catchment area, women veterans, who are enrolled in the VA. And then this shows you the market penetration based on VA users. So this is the percent of women veterans who live in a catchment area who are actually using VA services. One thing, it's not shown on these slides, but one thing that we note and has been very persistent over the years is that the market penetration for users and enrollees for women is persistently about 10 percentage points less than that of men across the system. This next slide focuses on diagnoses, and this is actually data that's developed by VSSC, pulled out of the corporate data warehouse. And so this is very different from some types of data that we often report on women's health conditions, where we use a method of developing sort of buckets or groups of conditions, which can actually be more useful than this. But this is just a raw list of individual ICD-9 codes. And so showing you that the most commonly coded diagnosis is hypertension, followed by depressive disorders, PTSD, lumbago or low back pain, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, etc. When I look at this, I always find it very interesting because I feel that these very common conditions really sort of fall into three categories. And you think of cardiovascular risk factors, mental health conditions, and chronic pain conditions. Those are our really most common buckets of conditions among women veterans. So the next thing that the WATCH survey does is ask our women veteran program managers about strategic planning. We have always put a huge emphasis on strategic planning in women's health because it's so necessary because of the rapid growth of the women veteran population. So folks need to be planning now for a population that could be doubling again in a few years. And so we saw last year at the end of FY17 that 91% of 140 healthcare systems had a written strategic plan, but it certainly varies a bit across visits. Some visits, 100% of their sites have a strategic plan, and others are lagging behind a bit in their strategic planning. And then this slide, it shows the time trend of how we've been doing with strategic planning. Now, what's of interest here is that in FY14, our program office had it really a big concerted effort on strategic planning, and we released a strategic planning toolkit and did quite a lot of education around strategic planning. And so we can see that that was actually really helpful, and it's fallen off just a tiny bit since then. And it can vary year by year because sometimes sites develop a strategic plan, but then, you know, 1 year it's completed, the next year they make a change and they have to get it reviewed by leadership and that sort of thing. That's usually typically what we hear from the sites when we question them about why this data could get worse from 1 year to the next. We also look at the key personnel of the Women's Health Program. And so it is required that every healthcare system should have a Women Veteran Program Manager. We can see that as of the end of FY17, 130 healthcare systems had at least one full-time Women Veteran Program Manager. There were two that had one that was part-time, and that's actually outside of policy. Policy does require a full-time Women Veteran Program Manager. There were six that had filled it in their acting capacity, and then two that actually didn't have their position filled. So we hope that that was just a temporary thing, and because this is a point-in-time survey, we caught them at a time when the position was unfilled. We also have a requirement for a women's health medical director at every healthcare system. That person is the clinical leader for the women's health program, whereas the WVPM is the administrative leader. And we saw that 130 healthcare systems had a women's health medical director. Some sites call it a women's health champion. That's why we allow these two different terminologies. But so 10 healthcare systems were actually missing a women's health medical director or champion. And then there's a requirement for what we call a women's health liaison at the CBOC, and that person is really just a point of contact for the Women Veteran Program Manager, who helps her ensure that women's health policy is followed at the CBOC and helps her communicate information about women's health services out to the CBOC. So we can see that, it's pretty good. 119 of 140 healthcare systems had a women's health liaison at every single CBOC, but obviously still not at 100% or as high as we would like it to be. So we also look at the professional designation of the Women Veteran Program Managers. So typically the Women Veteran Program Managers are RNs or social workers, the biggest bucket of them being RNs. And then we have a good number that are also nurse practitioners, PAs, a small number who are psychologists, and MDs. But again, most Women Veteran Program Managers tend to be RNs or social workers. And when you look at the professional designation of the Women's Health Medical Directors, most are MDs, 93%, some DOs here in the red, and a small percentage of NPs and small percentage of PAs. In terms of clinical specialty, mostly internists, some family practice, and then 15% gynecologists and a few others. Support staff is very important for women's health programs. And one of the things that we've really been tracking is women's health care coordination. Women's health teams actually tend to have additional care coordination requirements over and above non-women's health primary care teams. And that's because they have additional screening programs, the mammography program, the PAP program, or cervical cancer screening program, and then also maternity care. So these types of care coordination, especially for mammography and maternity care, where much of these services is actually done outside of the VA through non-VA community care. So it's really critical for women's health teams that they have personnel in place to do this type of coordination. You can see that only 55% of our sites had a mammo coordinator, 76% had a maternity care coordinator, and an even lower portion actually had someone assigned to be the PAP coordinator. What happens is if you don't have this work assigned to an individual, sometimes it overburdens the PAC team, or sometimes even gets put on the Women Veteran Program Manager, which is not really an expected part of the Women Veteran Program Manager's role. This slide shows us a very promising trend in terms of maternity care coordination. So you can see that back in FY11, hardly any sites had maternity care coordinators. We do have a policy that requires a maternity care coordinator at every site. And so as of FY17, we were up near 80% of all sites having a maternity care coordinator. So I'm going to move on into talking a little bit about comprehensive primary care. And I did mention this before, but what is comprehensive primary care? So when we talk about women's health, comprehensive primary care, what we mean is the provision of complete primary care and care coordination at one site by a designated women's health primary care provider and a women's health PAC team. So this refers to the women's health primary care provider being able to fulfill all the needs of our women veterans, with including their sort of general primary care or their care for acute and chronic illness and preventive services, but also their gender-specific care, meaning that the designated women's health primary care provider should be able to do the basic gender-specific care like pap smears, treating vaginitis, treating menstrual disorders, doing contraception, and that type of care. Again, I mentioned earlier in the talk that there are three models of care. So a women's health primary care provider can practice in any one of three models of care, the model one being the general primary care clinic that I talked about, the model two being a separate but shared space, and the model three being a comprehensive women's health center. This slide shows us the distribution of these different models of care as of the end of FY17. And so, what's really interesting is, I know this slide is kind of busy and a little bit hard to grasp, but out of 165 medical centers, there were 68 model three clinics. Remember, those are the comprehensive women's clinics, 31 Model 2 clinics, the separate but shared space, and 161 that actually had a Model 1 clinic where the women are being seen in the general primary care clinic. Now, this may be confusing because obviously it adds up to more than 165, but what this means is that most of these sites that have Model 2 and Model 3 clinics, some of their women are also seen in the general primary care clinic. So it's very unusual that you have a site where no women are seen in the general primary care clinic. And then if you look over at the C box, you'll see that for, obvious reasons, most C box are not big enough to have a separate women's comprehensive clinic. So the typical model for a C box is a model one or general primary care. Whereas there are a few very large C box that actually do have a separate women's clinic, 14 of those, so it's kind of astounding, but that's, we really do have that many CBOCs that have their own separate women's clinics. So adding those together, you'll see the total number. This is a question we get asked a lot. How many comprehensive women's clinics are there across the country? People tend to sometimes think there's one in every medical center, but that's not the case. So anyway, I'll move on to the next slide. So again, to talk about designated women's health providers, I talked about this a little earlier too, but a designated women's health primary care provider is a primary care provider, but someone who is trained and experienced in women's health and then preferentially assigned women veterans to their primary care panels. We have data that women who are assigned to designated women's health providers are actually more satisfied with their care and have higher quality of care than women who are assigned to non-designated women's health providers. And actually, to backtrack a little bit, the reason for having designated women's health providers across VA is that, as you know, since the population of women in VA for many years was very low, many of our providers who've worked in VA for a long time have become rusty in their women's health skills. That's one thing. The other thing is, if you distribute women just randomly across all providers, then most providers would end up with very small panels of women, and that makes it difficult for them to maintain their proficiency and also for their whole team to have all the processes and procedures in place that enable them to really smoothly provide women's health comprehensive care. So we have requirements to be a designated women's health provider, and they are fairly minimal, but it's meant to ensure that the women's health providers have either experience or some recent training. So to be initially designated, you need to have any one of all of these listed requirements. So having attended a women's health mini residency within the last 3 years, or having at least 20 hours of CME or CEU that's equivalent to the mini residency, or if you've recently been in a practice that's more than 50% women, you would certainly be experienced. Or if you had just recently completed your training, we would assume that you would have had training to take care of both men and women. There are some folks that are inexperienced, but they have a preceptorship arrangement, so they're meeting regularly with an experienced women's health provider, and then other folks who are recognized as being known leaders in women's health and subject matter experts. So again, any one of those things can get you designated, and then to maintain the designation, it's just a requirement to complete at least 10 hours of CME or CEU in women's health every 2 years. How are we doing in terms of having designated women's health providers across our system? One thing I can tell you that is that 76% of the women in primary care across the country right now are assigned to designated women's health primary care providers. So it's not at our goal. Our goal is 85%. We don't make it 100 because we know that some women prefer to keep a provider who's not a designated women's health provider, but we're striving for a goal of 85%. You can see that we have at least one designated women's health provider in all of our healthcare systems, and that's actually been true for many years. But if you look at all of our sites of care, including medical centers and CBOX, we have really been, sort of persistently at about 90%, and you'll see in the later slides that this is mostly related to some of our CBOCs that don't have a designated women's health provider. So this slide is showing you the percent of sites with 0, 1, or more than one designated women's health primary care providers. You can see that most of our medical centers have more than one, which is a very good thing. We actually would like every site to have at least two, so there's somebody who's available to cover for vacations and sick leave and such. So there is a percent of our medical centers that still only have one. And then in the green is those that have zero. And again, because this was just a point in time, we're hoping that that was because, you know, somebody had just left and they haven't had a chance to fill the position just yet, something like that. Most of our medical centers do have at least one designated women's health primary care provider. Now, at the CBOCs, you see a slightly different story, more of them having just one. And then, again, this about 10% of our CBOCs without any designated women's health primary care providers. And that's, of course, you know, a big gap in care for women veterans. And, you know, our office, as well as a lot of local sites, have a lot of initiatives in place to try to improve this by doing things like our Women's Health Mini Residency Training, where we've trained over 5,000 providers at this point. There's also local training. And this year, we have a new initiative where we are bringing the mini residency curriculum out to our rural CBOCs through a contractor team to try to really target those sites that don't have a designated women's health provider. This is just showing you kind of the time trends, what's been going on in the medical centers. You know, so you can see that in the medical centers, there's been a slightly growing number of sites that have more than one designated women's health provider. Same in the CBOCs, that's growing a little. The number with only one is declining. But, you know, this persistent trend of the CBOCs over the years that don't have any women's health providers. So next, to talk a little bit about the PACT team. So a PACT teamlet for women's health should include the women's health PCP and then, of course, the required staffing ratio of 3-to-1, where you have a nurse, a clerk, and a health tech or LPN or LVN. For women's health teams, we actually recommend a 4-to-1 staffing ratio. And so that is to encompass the need for chaperones for gender-specific exams. And then also, because of the increased care coordination requirements for women's health teams. So we look at the number of sites across the whole system that have at least one women's health PACT teamlet that's designated in PCMM, and that's at 88% of all the sites. Now, what it should be, it should roughly correlate with the number of women's health primary care providers that we have, because whenever the women's health primary care provider on a PACT team, or whenever the primary care provider on a PACT team is a women's health provider, then that teamlet should be designated as a women's health teamlet. And again, percent across the years that have at least one women's health PACT teamlet. Some sites obviously have women's health providers and don't have their PACT teamlets appropriately designated in PCMM. That's what this data is telling us, because the number of PACT teamlets or the percentage is slightly lower than the number of sites with women's health providers. And then we look at staffing. And so this is always, you know, a somewhat distressing slide to look at so that we see that teamlets with a 3-to-1 ratio, and this is so model 3 is in the green, model 2 is in the red, model 1 is in the blue. And so, you know, we see that for all three of our models of care, the women's health teams are, you know, below 80% of them actually have the recommended even 3-to-1 ratio when, you know, we actually recommend a 4-to-1 ratio. And, you know, what's concerning is that these staffing levels for RNs, clerks, and health techs, LPN or LVN, are actually the lowest for the comprehensive women's clinics. So this is problematic and something that we need to be really working on all across our system. Of course, we know that these staffing deficiencies are not unique to women's health, and that they're seeing across PAC teams across the system. The next thing we looked at is co-location of specialty services and by model of care, looking to see whether we have co-located specialty mental health, but co-located gynecology, social work, or pharmacy. And so this is interesting data. Specialty gynecology, of course, being highest in the Model 3 clinics, as you would expect. And interesting to see that mental health, social work, and pharmacy, you know, tend to be sort of lower in the Model 3 clinics than they are in the Model 1 or general primary care clinics. The data on mental health is a little bit confusing because this is supposed to refer to specialty mental health, but my belief is that when people answer this question, they confuse it with primary care mental health integration, which we'll have a separate slide on. Then we looked at co-located telehealth services. So again, just interesting to see the rates of telehealth. So telemental health fairly high, and then the other forms of telehealth are of course lower, with telegynecology being slightly higher in the Model 3 clinics. And then we looked at the same thing, looking at specialty services in CBOC primary care clinics. And again, you can see that, you know, fairly high rates of co-located mental health. Again, most likely this is not representing specialty mental health. In CBOCs that do have a Model 3 clinic, they do tend to often have a co-located gynecologist. And then interestingly, in the Model 3 clinics that were in CBOCs, even though the numbers are really small, they were more likely to have social work or pharmacy. And again, this is looking at the co-located telehealth services in CBOC primary care clinics. And this looks at our time trends. This slide, I think, is very complicated to look at. But this is for just the Model 3 clinics. So these are, again, our women's clinics, and really looking at a time trend to see if the co-location of mental health or the co-location of gynecology, social work, or pharmacy, has that really changed or improved over time. And so, you know, gynecology is actually required to be co-located. If you have a Model 3 comprehensive women's clinic, you're supposed to be required to have gynecology co-located. So you can see that this is only at 80% and it really hasn't improved much over time. Social work, again, is improving, and pharmacy looks like it's been somewhat up and down. So again, as I was saying before, we looked separately at primary care mental health integration. So it was reported as 68% for Model 1 clinics, 84% for Model 2, and actually 88% for the Model 3 clinics. And this is looking at the time trend in what's happening in the percent of clinics with primary care mental health integration. We do see that, you know, the Model 3 clinics over time are getting a little bit better, so that's encouraging news. Of course, again, it's really required to be 100%, so we're not there yet, but some gradual improvement. So specialty gynecology I'm going to talk about next. And again, as I mentioned before, a lot of the basic gynecology, what we would think of as gynecology services, like doing pap smears and treating minor gender-specific issues, that is usually done by our designated women's health provider. So when we talk about specialty gynecology, what we mean is services that are, consultative or a woman veteran is referred by the primary care provider for more advanced gynecologic care. So we want to know where the gynecology services are being provided. If we look at, let's look first at the Model 3 clinics. So that's the comprehensive women's clinics. So we ask them where specialty gynecology is most often provided. And so most often in the Model 3 clinics, it's provided at that clinic. Next commonly, it could be provided at another clinic within that VA site. So presumably at that site, they have a separate gynecology clinic. Less common at another site within the healthcare system. The green here is through non-VA, through community care, essentially, which, seems unusual for a Model 3 clinic, which is supposed to have co-located gynecology, but you can see that it's occurring. I'll move over now to talk about Model 1, and you can see that, the pattern looks quite different, and that's to be expected. These are integrated primary care clinics. So it would be very unusual that they would have co-located gynecology. Typically at another clinic within that site or even at another site within the healthcare system. So I won't go through all of this in full detail, but you can sort of get the picture. Just looking at the same data, but looking at it by medical center, whereas I believe I'm going to just go back. This one is by, by model of care. I'm getting confused about my own slides here. I'm sure you must be getting confused too. The next one is looking at it by medical center, as I believe the previous one was by healthcare system. So you can see the same kind of trend where in the Model 3 clinics, it's most often received in that clinic. In the Model 1 clinics, it's most often received at another clinic in that site. And then if you look at CBOX, so for those small number of CBOCs that have a Model 3 clinic, gynecology is most often received there. But the thing that we really don't want to see is these bottom two bars where women are having to travel more than 50 miles to receive their gynecologic care. So this is a very bad thing that we don't want to see. So that in the Model 1 CBOX, a substantial portion are, traveling more than 50 miles within their healthcare system to get their gynecologic care or even outside their healthcare system. And then the green would be, that the women are being referred into the community, which would be if there's not a gynecologist in the VA within 50 miles, it would be preferable to refer the patients into. Okay, so that actually was the end of my slides, and you have my contact information here. I'm happy to answer any questions, either right now or by phone or email in the future.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So for our attendees, to submit a question or comment, please use the GoToWebinar control panel located on the right-hand side of your screen. Down towards the bottom, click the arrow next to the word questions. That will expand the dialog box, and you can then submit your question or comment there. The first question to have come in, do you know which healthcare system has two women veteran program managers?
Not off the top of my head, but I believe that that's a healthcare system that has two large medical centers.
You mentioned this was an annual survey. Has the FY18 one already been administered?
No, it goes out in the fall, so it will be, they'll get the survey in October, and they'll be reporting on data through the end of fiscal year 18.
Has an in-depth look been seen in the trends since the beginning of the survey? Anything of note that has either raised concern or shown cause for congratulations?
Yes. I mean, we do look at the trends on all the data, and I think I was showing you the trends, and the things we're really tracking are the number. I think the most important thing we track the trends in is the sites with designated women's health providers. That's really been our biggest focus in terms of. The number of designated women's health providers has been gradually increasing, but like I said, we've seen that kind of been fairly flat in terms of that 10% of CBOCs that have not had, designated women's health primary care providers yet. I think that's our most significant trend that we've been tracking.
Has there been any discussion of incentivization for filling those missing roles?
We've been working on all kinds of ways to try to get those roles filled. As I talked about training, there is incentivization locally that sites can do in terms of if they're struggling to hire some sites do incentivize their existing women's health providers through the pay for performance process. So yes, that has been discussed.
Thank you. The next question. What is the downside of having women's health primary care providers maintain a minimum competency of 5 continuing medical education credits a year instead of the 10-2 since we complete WATCH and DAWC annually?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think that the reason we thought about the 2-year cycle was because that's the typical credentialing cycle at the facility, so that folks have to report their CME every 2 years at the facility level.
Thank you. We do have people writing in wondering where they can get a copy of these slides. You do have a copy in the reminder email you received 4 hours ago, or you can write in and I can send you the link. That is the final pending question. While we wait for any more to come in, do you have any concluding comments you'd like to make?
I just wanted to remind folks who are asking for the slides, too, that this data is available on VSFC if you wanted to just, have the data points. Yes, other than that, I just still like to thank everyone for their attendance. And again, because, I noted that 67% of the audience wasn't familiar with the WATCH, I'm glad that I had the opportunity to educate a lot of folks about women's health. So thank you very much for attending this session, and please feel free to reach out if you have any additional questions.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Haskell, for coming on and lending your expertise to the field. And thank you to our attendees for joining us. As I mentioned, this session has been recorded, and you will receive a link to the follow-up. a follow-up email with a link to the recording so you can share that with your colleagues. I am going to close out the session now, so please wait just a moment while the feedback survey populates on your screen and take a second to answer those few questions. We do look closely at your responses. So once again, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Sally. And this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar.